Welcome to Influential She, the podcast about accelerating the influence of women in the world.
You will find us to be a fresh voice in an old conversation.
And here we are, your amazing co-hosts, Deb Soholt
and Mel Schopp.
Well, welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Influential She, our conversation to accelerate the influence of women in the world. I'm your co-host, Deb Soholt.
And I'm Mel Schopp, and we are absolutely thrilled today to be on the Bowie State campus with Triopia Washington, who is a longtime friend of mine and that has really been an important person in my life for so many different reasons. And if I think about somebody who's been influential, Triopia, whether you know it or not, you've been influential for me as a woman, as an individual with my family, and I know for a number of people in South Dakota. And so today we're going to focus on the high leverage practice of story. Everything starts with a story. You know, stories have that power to connect us to other people. They hold the power to trigger our imagination and our empathy. And when you really think about our relationships with others, people are more likely to remember our story than our bios or other things about us, because those stories provide a glimpse into who we truly are as an authentic person. And that's what I appreciate and know about Triopia, as being this authentic soul through the power of her story. Triopia has many different things that you've accomplished in your life, but there's been one event that has always kind of stood out and that shaped many of the stories that you have. And I do want you to tell us a little bit about that today. It's the event, I always think about it as the Little Rock Nine, and you can probably articulate that better. So if you can give us some background on that. But I think also, and I'm going to be interrupting you because many of the things that you've shared with me have been about all the other things outside of just that event that were impactful, from the things that you and your family went through, the impact that your mother had in bringing the sort of woman that you are today. I'm going to be interrupting you here and there, if that's okay.
That's okay.
Okay. But if you can just start off and just start and tell us a little bit about you and how you play into that story of the Little Rock Nine.
Little Rock Nine was a historical event. This was the integration crisis at Little Rock Central High School in 1957. Of course, it all began with the Supreme Court decision in 1954 that literally eliminated segregation in public schools. And states were advised to proceed with deliberate speed. Well, deliberate speed means different things to different people. So in Arkansas, it was decided that the integration process would begin with the high schools in Little Rock. And at that time, Little Rock Central High School, there were two high schools. My alma mater, Dunbar High School, which was completely segregated, and Little Rock Central High School. I found out later during the year of 56 that my brother was, I don't want to use the word selected because that really doesn't describe how it happened, but he was identified as one of the students who would integrate Little Rock Central High School. Well, I was excited because prior to that year, when I was a student at Dunbar, our football team was allowed to play in the Central High Stadium on Friday nights. So every Friday night in the fall, we would walk by this gorgeous, humongous, beautiful school that was three times the size of ours. And it didn't take a rocket scientist to know that if a school is three times larger, there are three times more things going on. So when Ernest was given the opportunity to become one of the students to integrate, I was excited. We knew that there would be people who would be unhappy, but Little Rock had never been a place where there had been outward hostility, so we didn't really expect anything much.
I'm going to interrupt you really quick because I think you've told me too that what's interesting about it that in the time you were living, it wasn't that there was a lot of unrest in Little Rock. It was pretty, you know, you felt like you were in a pretty middle class situation, and there wasn't a lot of tension between the blacks and the whites at the time. Is that a correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I guess growing up, again, my mother was a teacher, my aunt was a teacher. Growing up in a very comfortable middle class situation, there were no real opportunities to experience hostility. To this day, I reflect and wonder if my mother and father experienced things or knew things that we didn't know. But again, it was a very comfortable life, and we anticipated Ernest entering Central. And I remember the summer before that September, there were meetings and people talked about how things should go and whatnot. But again, we felt pretty secure in that it would go well. I was teaching. I had just begun to teach in Baltimore. And I had visited home. I returned, I think, the Saturday before he was to enter that Monday. And again, I was very satisfied that things were okay and things would go along as they should. My principal that Monday morning walked over to my room. I was teaching kindergarten in a portable building. And she asked if I knew about the riots that had occurred in Little Rock. Well, I was in an absolute state of shock. I said, people in Little Rock don't riot. And I guess all that day, I just was kind of wondering why she would say something like that. And it wasn't until I arrived home that evening and looked at the news and saw what was going on. I was in a state of disbelief. I immediately called home. And my mother said, as she would do every time we talked, because I think I called home every day, she said, Triopia, you have your kindergarten children to be concerned about. We are just fine. Don't worry about us. After the first day that they were to enter, they were escorted out by the local police because the rioting had become so gross that people feared for the feared for their lives. Mm-hmm. So for about 3 weeks, they were tutored at Ms. Daisy Bates' home. And I think it was the night after my brother's birthday on September 22nd, that each parent received a telegram from President Dwight Eisenhower stating that the next day he was sending in 1,000 troops from the 101st Paratroopers Division in Kentucky to escort the students. And we think what happened, perhaps it wasn't necessarily that he was focused on the students getting in school, but he had been defied by the governor. They had met previously, and the governor had agreed to comply with the Supreme Court decision, and he did not. He used the National Guard from Arkansas not to help the students get in, but to keep them out. And President Eisenhower, I'm sure, was very miffed with that action. And he called, and that night, 1,000 troops flew into Little Rock, set up a camp on the school grounds with tents. And that morning, well, the students met at Daisy Bates' house, and they were in two sedans. There was a Jeep in front with soldiers with machine guns, a Jeep in back with soldiers with machine guns. And that's how they went to school the first day. And my brother's comment was, I think we will get in school today. So the year went on, and when May came, it was unbelievable that he had not only completed his work, but had reached the point where he was going to graduate. And I guess we talked the day of graduation, the night before, and I learned then that the principal had called and asked if he wanted his diploma mailed to him, because the principal had received information that he would be shot if he walked across that stage. And Ernest's response was, no, I did not persevere this year not to let my family see me receive my diploma. And he participated in graduation. And the big surprise was that Reverend Martin Luther King accompanied my mother and family to graduation. It seems that Dr. King was speaking at Arkansas A&M College in Pine Bluff, and he heard about Ernest's graduation and called Daisy Bates, who was president of the NAACP, who worked with the students that year, and asked if he could come to the graduation. And he came, and we have been asked, I've heard Ernest has been asked, well, what did you and Dr. King talk about? Ernest said, nothing. I was 16. I was graduating. My mind was on receiving the diploma. And then his friends at his former high school, I think, had a party for him after his graduation. So he, of course, during the years later, we realized how important that was.
So Triopia, you were talking about, all right, you had this lens of the world that, you know, we're existing peacefully within this community. Like, I would have no mental model that would tell me that this community that I felt safe and trusted in and were, you know, living and working together, that it would somehow almost turn on us and become a place of riot. So how did that experience as a woman really start to shape your story moving forward? Because it shifted dramatically.
You know, that's an interesting question. And I guess, haven't focused on it consciously. But while all this was going on, the attention from around the world really kind of superseded the negative. There was, I wouldn't say a balance, because certainly Ernest and the other students were going through a horrific experience. But again, the support, I remember Ernest received telegrams from all around the world, from people congratulating him and just saying, in essence, keep up the good work. So it, and then my mother, family, never looked at the negative side of things. That was just not what they did. And mother always found something positive. And in fact, I never recall any conversation with her in which she expressed negative feelings. I knew she was going through a lot, but never, ever did she articulate.
Extraordinary role model to hold that. Because, of course, I mean, here's your baby going into school, you know, mama bear protecting, and you've got the National Guard that's needing to be an escort. I mean, just the bravery of the whole family unit to be a part of that.
Well, that's, and it's, I guess, I'm not surprised, because that's kind of the way she was. I remember once she made a statement, I'm talking about something, and she said, there should be no such thing as worry. Said, if you have a challenge, you think about, you analyze it, think about what you can do about it, do what you can and then leave it alone.
Wow.
And that was how she lived. And that, I think that that kind of posture really is what Ernest had adapted and what he used as he went through that year. Because even today, as I've shared with friends, we don't sit around talking about that. We do other things when we get together. So there are things that I still don't know and that I probably will never know. But his position and my mother's position was he made it through.
Tropia, there's another story that I think is really is important because I think that it is also, it has another part to it. If you can go back and talk about when your mother received her master's degree, got the package in the mail, if you can tell this, and then how you, many, many years later, resolved that situation, I think it says a lot about you. Can you just share about the situation and in the time in which you, your mother was going to get her graduate degree and what happened there? Because that's a really powerful story.
Back in, quote and unquote, the day, Black teachers in the South were required to have the same credentials as other teachers, but Southern universities did not allow them to matriculate there. And I know my mother's, many of my mother and aunt's friends received their master's from University of Iowa, University of Minnesota, New York University. But a few years before I graduated from high school, the University of Arkansas established satellite courses on Saturdays in trailers in Little Rock. So because at that time, the three of us were young, and my mother couldn't afford to go away 6 weeks in the summer. So she began to take these courses from the University of Arkansas. And I remember she said, I want to finish before you go away to college. So in 1951, she completed all of her work for her master's degree. And I was standing with her at the door the day the postman brought this box. And the box was from the University of Arkansas. And in it, I think, was her tassel, her diploma, and a letter that congratulated her for completing her work, but telling her, and I remember the sentence precisely, this is not the time for you to come to campus to receive your degree. And my mother, as I alluded to before, was not a negative person, but I remember she read the letter, gave it to me to read, and when I handed it back to her, she crumpled it and threw it in the trash and walked away and never said a word to me about it. I'm sure she talked with her sister, but she never said a word. And as years passed, I just could not forget that moment. And I don't think I even told my brothers about it. But I was at the National Board of Professional Teaching Standards, where I served as a vice president. And it was January the 4th. And it was 2011. And for some reason, I went online and I pulled up the bio of the chancellor at the University of Arkansas. And as I read it, he seemed like an approachable person. So I decided at that moment to send him an email. And in it, I described the event with my mother. I described my brother's experience at Central High. And I ended by saying, it has been our wish that one of us could one day receive her diploma in the manner that was denied her. So I remember when I hit send, I recall that the University of Arkansas was playing football in the Sugar Bowl that day. And I said, oh boy, nobody is ever going to see this email. To my surprise, 2 days later, I received a reply from the chancellor. And he said that he described how sorry he was that that had happened. And he said that the university has changed and I would like to do something to make it right. So that began a series of conversations with him and with his vice president for diversity. And it ended up that the chancellor invited me to come to graduation in May and receive my mother's diploma. There were 4,000 graduates mm-hmm. and 20,000 people there. There were two seats in the front row that said Family of Lothair S. Green. And my son and I sat in those seats. And we were told, when it's time for you to receive your mother's diploma, the marshal will come and escort you to the stage. Well, after the undergraduate degrees were conferred, the chancellor did this beautiful speech, and my mother's picture was shown on the Jumbotron. And he talked about how she was denied participation in graduation simply because of her race. And it was just a beautiful, beautiful speech. So before they conferred the graduate degrees, my son and I were escorted to the stage. And the chancellor, the president, the chair of the board of trustees, all were standing there and congratulated us. And I received my mother's diploma.
It's just so beautiful. And I think what's so interesting, Triopia, about this is that the role modeling of your mother of taking difficult situations, being tough about it, but not becoming so outwardly, of course, she experienced anger. I don't want to minimize that, but the graciousness within which she kind of held her character. Then you took this story, and you never know when a story is going to keep going on or be completed or brought to closure. And like all these years later, you picked up the thread of that story and gave it the dignity that it deserved. I mean, I think that's just, it's amazing.
It's powerful.
It was, I was interviewed right after graduation, but one of the local stations. And I was asked about my feelings. And I guess my response was, you don't undo history, but it's important when people try to do things to amend wrongs that have occurred. And that's exactly what the chancellor did. And it was, the people at the university could not have been more gracious. I remember as we descended from the stage, a woman who was obviously a faculty member came out and grabbed me and hugged me, and she was in tears. And she said, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. But it was just, it was a joyous occasion. And I was also asked, well, what would your mother say? I said, she would say, Triopia, you know, you did not have to do this. I could see, because she was never one to place yourself in a position of notoriety. That was a big no-no in our family. But I said that I would probably reply, but I'm glad I did.
Yeah, so I think, you know, as we were talking about where you really have made the impact, it's through the power of story, because you have been able to take those stories, but be able to influence so many people by using your stories, not in a way, because there's many ways that you could have come at this. Even in your response to the chancellor prior to that, there could have been anger over the situation that happened. Or I think about many stories you've told me about your mother and the way that she always reacted to when there was potential discrimination, mm-hmm. and how instead of using that that those stories you have told and shared with other people have really helped to mitigate and to really help people to understand a different lens of how we should be thinking about our interactions in some of these racial situations that have sometimes been contentious. But you've been a model, I think, to many people, including myself, about the power of being gracious and using your powerful words to influence other people. And I don't know if you have anything you'd like to say about that, but I remember some stories you told about your mother where instead of being, the tendency in my mind would have been to be angry at words that were being said to you, but you've taken that and you've always been gracious and be able to share that story that I think helps all of us to learn from that.
And I guess one of the things that I have tried to do as I have matured is to emulate my mother's attitude. I thought of another story I think I've shared with you. When Ernest was a toddler, and we were in a grocery store, and a little boy called him the N-word. And my mother's response was just loud enough for his mother to hear. She said, "It is unfortunate that his vocabulary is so limited that he has to use language like that." And that was the kind of, I was thinking about her the other day, and the two words, command respect and demand respect, I thought about, she commanded respect, never demanded respect. Because I don't think you can earn respect if you demand. But her actions, there was another situation too. In fact, there's a historian at University of Arkansas in Little Rock who wrote about Ernest's situation being one of the Little Rock Nine, but said that was preceded probably many years before because my mother and aunt, and I think I've shared this with you, were part of a small group of teachers who sued the Little Rock School Board for equal pay for black teachers. Because at that time, even though the requirements were the same, the pay, there was a huge differential in the pay. So they joined, they were both teachers at Dunbar High School at the time, and this group of teachers, there was a plaintiff. And they sued the school board. And the lawyer who represented the NAACP and represented these teachers was the lawyer, Thurgood Marshall. And wow. I think I was about 3 or 4, because Ernest wasn't born then. And I remember mother and daddy talking about Thurgood Marshall. And in those days, people of color couldn't stay in hotels. So my mother and father were asked to host Attorney Marshall when he came to town for one of his visits. And I, again, was about 4. And my mother said that Attorney Marshall would fly into Little Rock. Well, people traveled by train and buses in those days. So we had a big backyard. It's not quite as big now as I thought it was then.
Is that true?
So but, true.
But at 4, everything looks larger.
Right.
Yep.
So I stood at the back window waiting for the plane to land in our backyard. And I can remember I had a step stool and we had a large bank of windows across the back. And I was waiting patiently for Attorney Marshall to arrive. And the doorbell rang. And mother announced, "Attorney Marshall is here." Well, I was quite perturbed with him because I had been waiting all this time for the plane to
for
land.
For something big to happen.
Yes. And he had the audacity to come in the front door. I met his son some years ago. We both served in the Clinton administration. And I told him, I said, I don't think I ever forgave your father for disappointing me when that plane did not land in my backyard. But again, that was, I remember my mother and aunt talking about that, and they won the case. But again, it was not something that they talked a lot about afterwards. And that group of teachers knew that the plaintiff would be fired, so they collected enough money to pay her salary for the next year. So I guess that was one of the first civil cases that our family was involved in and probably helped inspire Ernest to do what he did.
So if you were, you know, with the power of story and how you're talking about it, I mean, there's just all kinds of messages in there about how you relate events and what they can mean can help to move other people forward as well. What would you say to women about how to frame their own stories and what to think about and how they can use the power of story to accelerate their influence?
You know, I think everybody has a story and everybody's family has a story. And sometimes it's a matter of just talking with people and learning what those stories are. Because I know every family has some kind of a powerful story. When I began work here at Bowie, the dean who hired me made me promise to write a book. And she evidently felt that I had something to share. I'm going to do that one of these days. But yeah, I just think it's important to know about your family. I sincerely believe you can't know where you're going unless you know where you have been. And many times we'll find things that perhaps are surprising, but certainly strengthening and fulfilling. And it's just, it's really, really important. Because I think sometimes people are not aware of their own strength and influence. And perhaps by learning more about themselves, it'll provide that extra oomph.
Well, thanks, Triopia. I mean, it just means a lot to me that you took the time with us today to share again more of your story. And you've been a very influential person that you may not even know. Sometimes I think you are so humble in the way that you approach life, but you have made a big impact with a number of people in a large circle that I know and way beyond that. So we want to thank you.
And thanks to all of our listeners that have tuned in for this podcast to hear the incredible life stories of Triopia Washington. As you can hear, just by telling stories and framing them in a way, in the way that she does, in the way that you tell your own story, can be very powerful and influential and help to move the world forward. So what we want to leave you with is, are you asking yourself what your story is and how are you telling it to others? And is it in a way that you have connected back to the power of who you are at the core of your being in a way to influence the world? Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed our podcast, we'd be so jazzed if you rate us on whatever app you use to find us. And hey, be sure to tell all your friends about Influential She.
And please visit us at InfluentialShe.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn. And you know what? If you come up with a new one, please let us know. In the meantime, remember, stay influential.